Approaching on a 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. On at 15 seconds, guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
This is just a short intro to a lecture given in 1958 in Vancouver, Canada by Wilbert Brockhaus Smith. Smith was the official who ran the Canadian government flying saucer investigation from 1950 to 1954. You'll hear in this interview Wilbur Smith talking about nuclear weapons. This has always been a big issue. UFOs are very concerned about nuclear weapons. You'll hear about Smith talking about areas of reduced binding, which he claimed were being created by nuclear tests, and that they were being warned by the UFOs about this. He makes reference in the lecture you'll hear to the boy's topside. The boy's topside were the intelligences that Wilbur Smith was tracking through a number of people. One was AFA, was the main one, and you'll hear him actually talk about a sighting from Tyla. Tyla was the garbage collector that was cleaning up nuclear contamination in the atmosphere. So this is from 1958. We've got a number, I've got a few audios of Wilbur Smith giving lectures. He died in 1962, so this is just before he died. A lot of this material is in my new book called The Canadian Government UFO Story, The Wilbur Smith Files. So this, again, is a lecture that Wilbur Smith gave in Vancouver, Canada in 1958.
I've been rather fortunate in that one of its best professional scientists has done perhaps more research work in this country on UFO phenomena than anyone else. Canada has been fortunate in that respect, and tonight we're indeed fortunate because that particular gentleman is here and has agreed to speak to us. So without too much more ado, except to say that Mr. Smith, the speaker, the gentleman in question, is, as far as I know, an advisor to NECAP, the organization of which you just heard. And so I'm very proud, ladies and gentlemen, to introduce to you Mr. Wilbert Smith of Ottawa.
Had access to the organization and opened a number of files. Unfortunately, the gentleman of the press climbed on this and made a big deal out of it. Matter of fact, some of the headlines concerning Project Magnet were set in larger type than the declaration of war. However, we carried the project through officially for about 4 years, and the last year of the four, we had a little ship set up in which we had a number of instruments, the idea being to try and coordinate sightings with scientific measurements. We had equipment for detecting any radio noise that might emanate from these objects, any gravitational disturbances which might result, any radioactivity which might be connected with it, and any magnetic disturbances. These four instruments were of a recording type and produced graphical lines on a recording tape using a four-pin recorder. This ran 24 hours a day with alarm circuits attached so that in case any of the pins moved beyond a prescribed limit, the horns would blow and the bells would ring and the boys in the nearby ionosphere station were supposed to come running to see if they could see anything. Towards the end of the year, we hadn't received anything of any great importance on the instruments. So we had been following up a number of contacts with these people from outside, so we arranged a special circuit. And one Sunday afternoon, we asked them if they would bring a craft down close enough so we could see if we got any indications. Unfortunately, the afternoon we chose was very heavily overcast, so we were not able to get a visual coordination, although we did get a number of squiggles on our instruments. The craft that they sent down, they said, was about 80 feet long, about 14 feet in diameter, and was cigar-shaped effort and was primarily for scientific observations, but for some reason or other they didn't get it any closer to the Earth than about 50 miles, so it wouldn't have been visible with the naked eye anyway. However, the gentleman of the press apparently found out about our long-distance telephone circuit. Anyway, they were out there in droves shortly after this experiment, and they made us so thoroughly annoyed that we simply closed the whole business down and went underground from there on, and that's where it still is, as far as the gentleman of the press are concerned. However, we have been following up every lead we could find. Some of the leads led to dead ends. We found a tremendous amount of garbage. We found a number of contacts that we believe to be sincere. Our technique of handling the contacts was to ask a number of rather general type of questions. We asked the same questions of all the contacts, and then we intercompared the answers. We found that in the majority of cases, we got back exactly the same answers from all the contacts. We felt that since this was the case, the contacts were probably authentic. A few instances, we got back answers which were completely inconsistent, and we discarded those contacts. Maybe they were authentic, but we just felt that we did not have enough confirmation to work on. So we confined our activities from there on to the contacts whose results we had been able to check. In following through our program of investigation, we have always felt that an unconfirmed report of any kind was of interest only. If we could get an additional confirmation, we figured that it had about something better than 50% probability of being correct. We had two independent confirmations, 75% probably correct, and so on. So that the material that I will be talking to you about a little later on is the result not of just one bit of information, but the majority of it has been the result of 3, 4, 5, and sometimes even more independent transmittals of the same information. Now, this information includes a great deal of philosophy a good deal of what you might say human engineering and a great deal of science. Being of a scientific background myself, my own interest was directed largely towards the scientific end. I wanted to know how these craft were built, what their motive power was, where they got the energy, and how come they were able to do such interesting things that our craft were unable to do. Many of the questions that I asked when I had the opportunity to ask them were along scientific lines. I will admit that I got back a great deal of information which was completely unintelligible. It sounded like a lot of double talk. However, since we had previously established that the contacts through whom we were obtaining this information were probably authentic, we simply took the information down either in writing or on tapes, and we kept it for future reference, and eventually we were able to get quite a bit out of it. There is a great deal that we have not yet been able to decipher. I think the trouble is with us, not with the information. Much of the information which we obtained from these people cast some serious doubts on the validity of some of the basic concepts of our science. For one thing, they told us that the velocity of light was not a constant. As a matter of fact, they seemed to be rather pointed in their statement that light doesn't travel, it is. And we told them that from our point of view, it appears to travel with a certain definite velocity of 186,000 miles per second. They said, that's the way it looks to you because you are looking at it in and from a region having certain conditions, certain influences. But they said, if you were to go away from this region, meaning the vicinity of the Earth, you would find that a different set of figures prevailed. Another thing they told us cast a great deal of doubt on our ideas of time. They told us that time wasn't at all what we thought it was, namely what might be marked off with the ticking of a clock. That time was in fact a field function, the result of there being a universe. That it was something which was derived from the basic primordial concept which brought this universe into being, and that it differed as you went from one part of the universe to the other. Also, it could be altered, sometimes by natural means, sometimes by intelligently controlled means in various parts of the universe, so that in any given interval, which incidentally is what our clocks mark off, our intervals, not chunks of time. In these intervals, we can have all sorts of lengths of time. In other words, if one of you checks your clock with me, finds that they are synchronized, and I climb into a flying saucer and take a little trip out well clear of this Earth, and I watch my clock and I come back in, say, 3 hours' time, we again compare clocks. Maybe your clock says I've been gone an hour, my clock says I've been gone 3 hours. Both clocks are strictly correct. You, in that given interval, from the time the big hand of the clock went around once, you experienced an hour. In that same interval of between the ticks of the clock, I experienced 3 hours. And they were three real hours, not an illusion. The theory of relativity talks about time dilation. But this leads to a paradox. And I think that anyone who is at all mathematically inclined and has taken the trouble to look at the relativistic time paradox has probably been rather disturbed by it. According to the theory of relativity, if I climb into a spacecraft and I start out from the Earth here at a velocity velocity, very nearly the velocity of light, and I go out to, say, Alpha Proxima, and then I turn around and come back. People on the Earth say I've been gone something like 10 years. According to my clock, I've only been gone a year. Now, that is a result, apparently, of the time dilation under the theory of relativity, in that the spacecraft, which I travel in, was moving relative to the Earth at a velocity very nearly equal to the velocity of light. The paradox arises when you consider that relative to the spacecraft, the Earth was traveling away at exactly the same velocity. Therefore, to the people on the spacecraft who are relatively stationary, 10 years should have passed, and by the time the Earth comes back to them, it should only have been away a year. So you can see right away the very premise upon which the theory of relativity is predicated, namely that if A is relative to B, then B must be relative to A, leads you to an impossible paradox. This paradox is resolved completely if you recognize the variable nature of time. And as you move around from one part of the universe to the other, you encounter all time, all sorts of values of time in certain given intervals. Now, I find that this idea of the concept of the variable nature of time to be almost incomprehensible to most people because, as they say, a Swede is only a Norwegian with his brains beaten out. I think that that is what has happened to most of us. We were born with more intelligence than we have after we graduate from university because we've had it beaten out of us in the process. The very first thing that we learn when we are a very small child is that the feeding must be regulated by a clock. We don't know about a clock, but regardless of how we feel on the subject, we still get the bottle at a certain particular time. And this carries on right through our conscious life. Every time we do something, we check with the clock. We become slaves to the clock to the extent that we believe that the intervals picked out by the clock are time itself. So we find it very difficult to readjust. Now, I don't propose to say any more about this particular aspect, but I would like to say something on the subject of the craft themselves. We asked them how they were supported, and they said they were supported on the Earth's gravitational field. We asked them what the Earth's gravitational field was, and they said it was a complicated function which had to do with the influences of the matter, the material which made up the planet which was producing the field. Further studies on our own, with occasional reference to these people from elsewhere, and we figured out what was really taking place. To the extent that we were able to go into the laboratory and conduct a series of experiments which proved beyond a doubt that this is true. Our laboratory experiments have allowed us to make about a 1% change in the weight of objects. We can make them about 1% heavier or 1% lighter. Now that is a long way from holding a spacecraft up because we have to go over 100% in order to do that. But the fact that we can do it, the fact that the principles which these people from outside gave us and guided us to finding out for ourselves are valid, certainly indicates that, first, these people are what they say they are, second, that their technology is what they say it is, that it is superior to ours, that ours is inadequate in many respects. Now, I ask for a blackboard here tonight because I want to draw a very small diagram on here, which I think may throw a little light on how these bells are actually held up. Now, the diagram is very simple. May be considered as the Earth's gravitational field. This is not a strictly correct representation because a field is a dynamic function, not a static one. Down here someplace is the center. As you can see, this is diverging outwards. If we place any object in here, this object is subject to attraction from this virtual center down here, on this side and on this side. But this side is closer than this side, so that we have a net resultant force down this way. However, if we bend this field, and we do this to it, this object now finds itself in a field, the virtual center of which is up here somewhere, so that the object now thinks that this is down and it proceeds to fall in that direction. Or if the field is bent until it is exactly parallel, there is no resultant force on the object and it remains weightless. It is just that simple. And this is precisely what we have done in the laboratory, but because the fields around the Earth are very intense, very, very intense fields, the fields which we have had available in our modern technology, good as we think it is, are most inadequate to do more than bend these fields by a very small amount, so that we have been able to bend the Earth's field to fool the little weight into thinking that that was down instead of this being down. Now, we understand that these bells operate on that principle. Underneath the bells, there are three things that people have referred to as landing gear. They're not landing gear at all. They're spheres within which a charged sphere is rotating. It is spinning on magnetic bearings. The magnetic bearing is something else that the boys from Topside gave us the design of. It's very simple in section. This is North Pole and this is South. And in it, they have a thing that looks like this with the South and this the North. They're just simply ferrite bearings, permanently magnetized. We built them ourselves and checked them in the lab, and they work perfectly. They're very simple things. And the spheres carry a charge, electric charge, and they spin on this type of bearings down inside these big balls. And the tilt is simply produced by rotating the sphere a little bit, which bends the field. The process is much more complicated than would appear from what I'm telling you. But this is the first step and the end result, even though there are a lot of steps in between. Other thing that I would like to mention, as far as I know, our group in Ottawa are the only group that has actually taken the information which was given to us by the boys Topside and translated it into hardware that works. Much information has been given to us through various channels, but people just talk about it. They don't do anything about it. And I think that is deplorable. I think when they give us information, the least we can do is to show our good faith by trying at least to convert that information into hardware. We have built two items of hardware on their instructions that I'm rather proud of. One of those pieces of hardware is a coil. It has a ferrite core and a trick winding on it. To look at it, it looks like a rather oddly wound inductor. When measured on a radio frequency bridge, however, it shows some very peculiar properties. There are certain frequencies at which it is impossible to balance the RF bridge, and that is a direct contradiction to what any electrical engineer will tell you should happen with a coil of wire wound on a ferrite core. Now, if we take this coil and we excite it with radio frequency energy at or near these critical frequencies, we find that energy goes into the coil and nothing comes out. It just disappears. As a matter of fact, we had one coil about an inch in diameter and 8 inches long, and we poured a kilowatt into that coil for 2 hours from a kilowatt communications type transmitter. The coil was in a 2-inch brass tube with a plate welded on one end and a transmission line fitting on the other, we could find no radiation around the outside of that tube at all. In other words, the energy went in, none came out. The information which we got from the boys topside was that we were actually making tensor energy, which is a six-dimensional radio wave. And it is the type of energy that they use extensively for radio communication, transmission of power, and for pushing and pulling. In fact, they use it for just about everything that we could think of. We were not able to control this energy. We could just make it. We are hoping that later on we will be able to learn how to do it. But at the present time, we're just not smart enough. The other item that I'm rather proud of resulted from a series of questions that we asked regarding accidental destruction or damage to our aircraft by flying into the vicinity of the flying saucers. And we were informed that although a few of our aircraft had come to an unfortunate end by what they considered the colossal stupidity of our pilots into flying into a region where the aircraft was bound to get into trouble, they said that they are now taking corrective measures, and whenever they see one of our aircraft about to commit suicide, they just get out of the way and give him a wide berth. But I asked if what happened, and they said, well, the fields around the saucers, in order to hold them up, in order to produce the gravity differentials, the time field differentials, which were necessary to operate the ships, these sometimes produced field combinations which reduced the strength of materials to the point where they were no longer strong enough to carry the loads that the materials were expected to carry. Now, as we know, aircraft, particularly the military-type aircraft, are built with a rather small factor of safety. And if they fly into a region of reduced binding, the material is no longer strong enough to carry the loads, and the craft simply comes apart. Now, we ask a series of questions about the was it possible for our craft to detect these regions so that we would not fly into them? And they said it certainly was, and they would tell us, give us the design of an instrument which would do this very thing. They told us also that we ourselves were creating regions which were much more dangerous. We could detect the presence of aircraft and give them a wide berth, but we could not detect without instruments the presence of these vortices which we ourselves had produced. Now, they gave us the design of the instrument, which was fundamentally this. They said to select two materials, one stronger than the other. And they said to arrange so that these two materials pulled against each other in such a manner that the weaker material was very near its breaking point and the strong material was a long way from its breaking point. On that basis, we devised instruments, and we built quite a number of them in the shop and sent them around to various people that we knew did quite a bit of traveling. And we asked them if they would investigate the regions through which aircraft must have passed just prior to breaking up in midair. And we have, unfortunately, a large record of our airplanes having done just this. One of these unexplained crashes occurred at a place called Isudun, which is about 20 miles south and west of Quebec City. And we investigated the region through which this BOAC aircraft must have passed just prior to the crash. And sure enough, big as life and twice as natural, we found a very large and very strong vortex. Our instruments showed it beyond a doubt. It was about 1,000 feet in diameter and roughly circular, with a rather sharp line of demarcation at the edge of it. You will recall also that about 2 years, 3 years ago, possibly a little longer, a jet aircraft crashed into a monastery, a nunnery actually, at Orleans, just out from Ottawa, and it killed a number of people and did a great deal of damage. In fact, the jet engine itself was finally dug out of the subsoil about 30 feet below the foundations of this convent. We investigated that one. Again, we found a very strong vortex of reduced binding. We had a number of reports come in from the people in the field who found exactly the same thing. I wrote a very stiff memorandum to the appropriate people in my own department, pointing out some of these facts. I did not state where we got the information, but we simply stated that we had instruments which showed the existence of these regions of reduced binding and suggested that something be done about it. The letter wound up on the crank file. I'm afraid that is the fate of most of these things. They wind up on the crank file. However, that does not in any way change the fact that these regions of reduced binding exist. People topside told us they existed. They gave us the design of instruments. We built the instruments. We have confirmed the fact. There's one other little point I would like to make in connection with these regions of reduced binding, and that is the people from elsewhere told us that we make them when we set off a nuclear explosion. We make two of them. We make one of them in the vicinity of the nuclear explosion and one on the opposite side of the planet. Any of you who have ever seen pictures or facsimiles of a nuclear explosion have probably noticed that there is a column which is approximately uniform diameter extending upward from the region of the explosion, and that is capped by a big mushroom-shaped cloud. That shape, that fact itself, should have been a sufficient warning to us that we were producing a very serious gravitational disturbance. I'll show you what happens. That circle represents the Earth. Out from the Earth, there is emanating, for sake of simplicity, let's call it a gravitational field. We have a nuclear explosion takes place at some point, such as this. A nuclear explosion means that there is a sudden change of matter to energy. In other words, we have a dmdt, which is large. In other words, that is very much greater than unity. Now, it is not difficult to show that if you have such a disturbance occurring in a gravitational field, there will be projected outwards a gravity wave, which will be projected in the direction of the gravity field and with a velocity which is inversely proportional to the strength of the gravitational field. Therefore, if the explosion itself, if the conversion of mass to energy lasts over a period of time which would permit the expanding materials to move out, say, 100 feet this way and 100 feet this way, we would have a region in here 200 feet in diameter in which mass was being converted to energy and which would be a virtual source of a gravity wave. That would travel straight up, thereby producing the column that we see supporting the mushroom cloud. What we don't see is that penetrating downwards through the center of the planet, there is a similar gravity wave. It comes to a focal point down here, and in this region, from approximately here on down, we have approximately the same mass all the way around, so the gravitational field in here is very low. So the velocity becomes very high, and this then flares out this way, so that it comes out from the far side of the Earth as a diverging cone. Now these things don't go away. We literally punch a hole in the field structure of the Earth. We punch a little round cylindrical hole on this side and a big conical shaped hole on the other side. They stay there for a long time. They're vortices, and they take them quite a while to dissipate. We don't know how long, but we have gone back to places such as Sudan 3 months later, and we have found that the vortex has gone. Now, maybe it has moved away. We believe that that is what happens, because we actually caught one of them moving. Or it maybe it dissipates, maybe both. But we did find one out over the North Atlantic that drifted, was picked up first by a friend of mine who is an RCAF pilot who had the instrument with him. They located it on a reconnaissance flight just to the south and west of Iceland. And then again, on a flight out about a week later, it was about halfway between Iceland and Newfoundland, and considerably weaker. At least that is the impression they got from the instrument indication. So that apparently they do move around, and I presume they do fade out. We haven't, incidentally, located any lately in the last year or so. I presume because we have not been exploding any bombs lately. Now, this is a bit of a review of our activities in Ottawa, what we're doing, and why we have been doing it. Now, I think that possibly the best thing I can do at this stage is to say that I will try and answer questions. I don't have all the answers. Maybe I don't have any of them. But if I can answer them, I'll certainly do my best. Thank you. We do not know. We have had no opportunity of placing a guinea pig in the area and keeping them there for any length of time. The vortex at Sudan extended, when we discovered it, extended partly over the highway and out into a field. There was no accommodation for anyone even to park other than on the shoulder of the road long enough to explore this. We just don't know. Yes, sir.
Can you explain to us why they have curtailed in the going up into their
I can only guess at why the nuclear explosions have been curtailed. I saw a picture, which I know was never released to the public, showing a very large nuclear explosion on the Bikini series. This picture showed the enormous fireball, which I think must have been well over 100 miles in diameter, and shooting out from it were what it looked like solar prominences. In other words, they were great tongues of activity of some kind. Now, these tongues were, looked to me from the picture, in the scale of picture, at around full 25, 50 miles. They were quite comparable in size to the big fireball. Now, my guess is that these tongues or prominences were, in fact, chain reactions taking place in the Earth's atmosphere. Now, what mechanism was involved, I can only guess. I'm not a nuclear physicist. I only know that this picture was considered by those knowledgeable to be very significant and very worrisome. I think the another reason possibly for the curtailment of the tests has been the rising public opinion that it would be highly undesirable to go any further into this business of nuclear weapons than we have gone. Possibly we have gone too far already. Yes, sir. We believe that as long as the elastic limit of the material is not overstressed, the effect is temporary. But if it is overstressed, the effect is permanent. Now, we found a very peculiar thing. Things in the northern latitudes generally appear to be somewhat stronger than they are in the southern latitudes. We had one instrument which we took from the Paw, Manitoba, through Ottawa, Washington, D.C., and out to Oklahoma City. And while the instrument, none of our instruments are calibrated in any kind of an absolute unit, simply because we don't know how to calibrate them in absolute units, they are merely scale indications. The scale goes around to 10. And we set them ordinarily about mid-scale, somewhere around 5 or 6. At the Paw, it went up to about 7.5, assuming that it was set at 5, went up to about 7.5. When it got down to Oklahoma City, it was down to 2. And when we took it back to Ottawa, it came back to the 5. We had set it at 5 in Ottawa. Now, that meant that there was not a permanent set in the nylon fiber, which was the weaker of the two opposing poles. However, every time we take one of these instruments into Toronto, we find that it promptly goes from 5 down to 2. And we have actually had several of the nylon fibers break when we've taken the instruments to Toronto. We came to the conclusion that Toronto may be good, all right, but it's not very strong. Incidentally, they have had an abnormal number of structural steel failures in Toronto when buildings have been undergoing construction. The steel has given way, bolts have given way. We believe that this is maybe a semi-permanent condition for Toronto, because we find that we encounter it just as we hit the outskirts of the city, and as we proceed through the city and towards Hamilton, we lose it again about Port Credit. So this is a very large region, and it seems to be permanent. I know it's been there for 4 or 5 years now that we've been investigating. Yes? I wouldn't put any money on it that it wouldn't. I would say that there's a very good possibility that these explosions have a far more disastrous effect down in the interior of the Earth than anything that we can see on the surface. I have the most serious misgivings about these atom bomb explosions. Yes?
But you have been given the reason to believe that the space people are in the business radiation proposition.
Yes, unfortunately, I cannot name names in this particular instance, because the contact, a personal friend of mine, he is an electronics engineer, and for reasons which I think if you knew him you would realize the obvious, he cannot have his name mentioned. But he has had contact with one of these people from outside now for a period of 4 years that I know of, and I believe that this contact has preceded that by several years. This contact's name, the man here on Earth, I cannot quote, but the man from outside, his name is Tyler, and he calls himself a garbage collector. His big job, he says, is to go around after we have misbehaved and clean up the mess. By misbehaving, I mean setting off nuclear explosions. Now, he gathers up this material, does something to it on board the craft, what we don't know, but it renders it reasonably inert. And then once a year, or thereabouts, it takes about a year to process this material, he dumps it in some rather secluded spot. In, I think it was 1947, November issue or December issue of Time magazine had a picture of Tyler's craft dumping this material out over the American desert. A year later, Tyler sent a message through my friend that he was going to dump some again, that he would this time pick an opportune time when many people could see the, could witness the process, and that he would dump it somewhere near Ottawa. So shortly after the armistice celebrations down at Confusion Square in Ottawa, everyone was buzzing around town. It was a very pleasant day. We looked up to the northwest of Ottawa, and there was Tyler's little craft, the lake-shaped affair, up in the sky, and coming out of the tail end of this was what looked like a almost dissipated portion of a jet trail. And this was dropping down. It was a white, smoky-looking affair that was dropping down from the rear of this little craft, which was set at about an angle of 30, 45 degrees. Well, we watched this through binoculars. In fact, having been warned, we had these things handy. We stood out in the yard, and I think about half of Ottawa was out watching it, too. And the dump took about 20 minutes. We stood there and watched it, and this tail of dust kept getting lower and lower. And finally, when we looked up again, Tyler's craft was gone. We didn't see him go. Maybe he just took off in a hurry when he figured the job was done. Anyway, we watched this dust until it had dissipated almost to the point where we couldn't really see it anymore, but by that time it was down pretty close to the horizon. Now, knowing the size of Tyler's craft, which is roughly 1,000 feet long, we calculated from the field of the binoculars, other data, that he was about 50 miles away from Ottawa and about somewhere around 15, 20 miles high, and just to the northwest of the city of Ottawa. Looking on the map, that region is completely and entirely uninhabited. There's just no one up in that area. The fact is, that area doesn't even drain into the Ottawa River. It drains into the Coquitlam River, which goes up into the Bering Straits. That is a question that is rather, I find, very intriguing, this business of appearing and disappearing. If you consider a point here about which the time is not uniformly distributed, in other words, as you come out from here, you have less and less and less time. We're looking at the other way, the temperature field is greater here than it is out here. If you have a beam of light, which consists of a series of wavefronts, passing through this region, since there is more time in here, pardon me, there's less time in this part, a greater temperature field intensity, or less time, this doesn't get to go as far in a given interval as this fellow does. So this light beam bends. So the direction is this direction here, but over here, it's in this direction. So what apparently happens is that the light is bent around this particular point, so that it's very much the same as the trick where the magician makes the elephant disappear on the stage. You're really looking at a mirror, and you see the curtains at the back, and they just simply switch the light off on the elephant, switch it on the curtain so that you don't see the elephant. To approach the saucer in this fashion, go around it off the other side, so that what little light comes directly from the saucer occupies such a very, very small portion of your field of vision that you think the saucer is, if you see it at all, you think it's tiny, about the size maybe of a dime or maybe the end of that piece of chalk, when in reality the thing may be 150 feet in diameter. You are literally looking past the saucer. Now, we saw one of the little monitors do exactly that trick. We had very good reason to believe that a certain conversation that we were having with a friend of mine was being monitored by one of these little fellows. So when we came out of the house, we made a definite effort to locate it. We did. It was down in the ditch just in front of the house. And as soon as we spotted it, apparently the people who were controlling it became aware of the fact. As soon as we spotted it, we saw what appeared to be just like a heat wave, something like a foot in diameter. Popped out of the center of this was appeared to be a little disc, about so big, and it just took off like that and disappeared straight through yonder. I think the whole operation probably occurred in less than maybe 2 seconds. But we were looking right at it, and there were three of us, and we all saw the same thing.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.